Pullman National Monument in Chicago, Illinois, with your host, Dr. Lynn Hughes.
We welcome you to Live from the Pullman National Monument, our global cast magazine format talk radio show, where we discuss all things culturally economic development, i.e. tourism, and we hold informative conversations on the arts, music, business, and people. I'm your host, Dr. Lynn Hughes, founder of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porta Museum, a National Park Service site in Chicago, Illinois. Good day to you, my listening audience, and we thank you for joining us. Stay with us. Coming up, Jason Lesnevich of CHU Chicago, next on Live from the Pullman National Monument. Stay with us. Today's show is partially underwritten by United Auto Workers, Local 551, and Hughes Peterson Publishing, Chicago, Illinois. We welcome you to Live from the Pullman National Monument. As we have established a tradition of explaining or discussing the Pullman National Monument, I will do that today. There's a lot going on, progress is being made, and we're coming up on our first anniversary of being designated as Chicago's first unit of the National Park Service, the Pullman National Monument. And while we were a little hazy in the beginning, and there was confusion about who, what, when, where, and why, things are sort of being mellowed out, if you will. We have now been given our first National Park Superintendent, Kathy Snyder, who visited our show a couple of weeks ago, actually. And so now maybe we will begin to have a little more organized and smooth sailing, if you will. But anytime you deal with government, things are always a little hectic and confusing. So we are still plugging along, and our visitorship has increased tremendously. We have visitors from all over the world who come to Chicago to visit the Pullman National Monument. We're also making progress in determining or revealing or organizing so that the perception of the Pullman National Monument is a bit more clear. I think those of you who are frequent listeners detected that we were talking about there being confusion about the recognition of the Pullman National Monument, because there were so many people who identified the Pullman National Monument as just one building, which was the Pullman Clock Tower, the administration building, and that is not the case. We are a little bit different from most national monuments. We are not just the one building. We are a collection of buildings, and we are viewed or described as a thematic district. So the boundary lines for the Pullman National Monument in the city of Chicago are, as the U.S. Department of Interior designated, I believe, in 1970s when they designated the Pullman Historic District as a national landmark district. And so the National Park Service used the exact same boundaries. So the boundaries for the Pullman National Monument are 103rd Street to 115th Street, the Bishop Ford Freeway to the IC or Metra Railroad line. And those are the boundaries for the Pullman National Monument. Within the monument, there are several tourist sites or sites that tourists can visit when they come to the monument. But what's important to denote is that the Pullman National Monument has significance because of the architecture. The entire district is Queen Anne design architecture. And it's pretty much intact the way that it was when it was built in the late 1880s. Now, within the National Monument, there are things that you can actually go see. There is, of course, the Greenstone Church. There is, well, the first stop would be the National Parks Visitor Center that's currently at 112th and Cottage Grove. And there you will encounter the park rangers with the hats, the whole full regalia to meet and greet you. And they serve at the visitor center as, I guess, a directional destination or feeder destination that will actually provide you with maps and descriptions and data that will send you or direct you to the various sites within the National Monument. Currently, within the monument, there's one restaurant. It's called the Pullman Cafe. And it's more of a sandwich shop, but quaint, intimate, very nice atmosphere. Now, there is the Greenstone Church that one can go in and see. There's something special about the organ in that church. There is the Market Hall, and it's basically you kind of walk through and see, marvel at the great architecture. Then there is the Pullman Clock Tower, and that is what is confusing for everyone. It's currently a factory building that is under construction. Part of it is under construction. And that is ultimately where the National Park Service will have their office and create the official visitor center for the Pullman National Monument. And then, of course, there is the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, of which I have the honor of being the founder. It is a 22-year-old cultural institution. It is currently the only museum, officially the only museum that exists now. It is a Black Labor History Museum. We happen to have the distinction of being the only one of its kind in worldwide, actually. We are considered, or what we describe ourselves as, is a boutique museum. It is a museum that specializes or has a 100% complete focus on Black labor history, with a particular emphasis on the onboard crew, the Black Railroad labor attendants, who were the onboard crew for the Pullman Company. And they were the founders of the first Black labor union in America. They were the first to have a collective bargaining agreement with a major U.S. corporation, which happened to be the Pullman Company. And that is why there was so much significance placed upon this particular component of American history. And please note that I said American history. It is not just Black history. It is a part of American history, because the contribution that these men made to not only to organized labor, but to civil rights, they contributed heavily into changing the atmosphere and the interaction between people in America, Black and white. So it's not just Black labor history. So what else is there? Let's see. We've talked about the Greenstone Church. We talked about the Visitor Center. The Pullman, Historic Pullman Foundation, may be the oldest entity that's in the Pullman National Monument. They have developed their niche as well, and they have something, they have an annual house tour where people who register and pay for the house tour can go throughout Pullman, where homeowners actually open their homes so that visitors have an opportunity to see the unique significance of these particular houses. And they're quite nice, quite architecturally. They're quite significant, quite attractive. And so people come from all over the country to attend and to participate in this annual house tour. And so we have lots of different things that we offer in the Pullman National Monument, things that we were doing long before President Obama designated it. We have just now been embraced by the umbrella of the National Park Service, which then gives, I guess, more significance nationally to what we have been doing for decades. And so we're all very proud of the work that we do. We're all very proud of the significance that we have attained by becoming a part of the National Park Service. And we like to think that we, all of us, do a very good job in doing what we do. We have been joined by the state of Illinois, Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, who actually owns the Pullman Clock Tower or the Pullman Administration Building. And so basically, we're all just sort of trying to find our way in how we can now set that we have a new partner, which is the National Park Service, just exactly how we will each of us be able to continue doing what we have been doing for decades. And in addition to that, maintain our own autonomy, which is going to be the trick, because each of us had already established our niche long before the National Park Service came. Case in point is the niche that the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum created by establishing or cultivating the niche of significance that highlights Black labor history, particularly that surrounds the Pullman Porters. But the thing is that what happens that people, you know, nobody likes to do anything at length. And so everybody wants to shorten things and create a soundbite. And so now that the federal government has taken an interest in the Black labor history component, which is what we do at the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. Now, everybody, even those in the monument, everybody wants to tell the same story. And so that's problematic, but we're going to work it out when each of the partners, and that's what we call ourselves, partners in the National Park Service area or the National Monument, we have to figure out a way that we need to define and continue to do or represent or interpret the niche that each of us created. And so whether it be architecture, whether it be the niche that we have created with the Pullman Porters, that we refuse to separate from A. Philip Randolph, because those of you who know the history of the Pullman Porters know that were it not for A. Philip Randolph connecting with them and them unifying themselves, there would not be a discussion about the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, because it was he who organized and galvanized these men and helped them to understand, helped them to get to the recognition that they needed to have, the importance of unity, the importance of self-respect, and the importance of standing up for yourself. And so by the time they collectively conceived and absorbed that concept, it was under his leadership that the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was born, which was America's first Black labor union, the first to win a collective bargaining agreement with a major U.S. corporation, which happened to be the Pullman Company. So you cannot separate the two. You just cannot, although people are trying. And so I hope that helps provide an explanation, if you will, for people who did not know this history. So I'm hoping that helps. Now, during the summer months, there's a tremendous increase in activity in the monument, and there are all kinds of wonderful things that happen, concerts and festivals and events of all kinds, which would interest the tourist coming to Chicago. And so we hope that, and maybe it's on BBS radio here, that we will provide some sort of calendar of events for the national and international visitors on our webpage for on the radio show's webpage that will talk about or direct tourists to these wonderful sites that they can partake in and enjoy. We love having visitors to the Pullman National Monument, and the increase in visitorship is getting a little bit difficult to handle, but we're new. All of us are new at this volume, but we're getting there. We're getting there. And so we hope that we will continue to grow in our experience and expertise in handling that kind of volume. We are going to take a quick break and be right back with our first guest. Today's show is partially underwritten by United Auto Workers, Local 551, and Hughes Peterson Publishing, Chicago, Illinois.
Support Hughes Peterson Publishing by visiting thepullmanmessenger.com and purchase an annual subscription. It's just $12 a year. Or purchase an Anthology of Respect by Dr. Lynn Hughes, available on Amazon.com.
Our guests today are two dynamic individuals. Both have very different but interesting professions. But both have jobs that are related to what our show is all about, tourism. Jason Lesnevich, who is Cultural Tourism Manager of Neighborhoods from CHU Chicago, and Samuel W. Black is the Director of African American Programs at the Senator John Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. As the title of our show indicates, live from the Pullman National Monument, the show is all about tourism, and a considerable focus for the show is all about neighborhood tourism. Our first guest is perfect for today's show. He is Jason Lesnevich, Cultural Tourism Manager of Neighborhoods for CHU Chicago. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is wonderful. I think I would like to start with your telling us a little bit about CHU Chicago. What is it and what does it do?
Sure. CHU Chicago is the sales and marketing organization for the city of Chicago. It was formed in 2012 under Mayor Rahm Emanuel to really make sure that we have a tourism agency focused on selling McCormick Place for conventioneers, but also making sure that we have a strong marketing arm to attract leisure visitors from the domestic markets and various international markets around the world. So that is our main purpose, is to make sure that we are filling McCormick Place and drawing as many leisure, sports, and business visitors to the city of Chicago.
Fantastic. You are considered the guru in Chicago on the topic of cultural tourism. So let's start with your, yay. Let's start with your giving a description to our listening audience and tell us exactly what is cultural tourism, and let's go from there.
You know, culture really helps define a people, a neighborhood, a city. And so it's really making sure that we promote and raise awareness of our cultural institutions, from the large museums like the Art Institute of Chicago, all the way down to the ethnic museums throughout the city, our dance scene, our theater scene. You know, when we talk about cultural tourism, we really talk about 12 disciplines that make up the cultural tourism landscape of Chicago, from architecture and historic sites to the dance, the theater, the music scene, the culinary scene in Chicago, our neighborhoods, our literary aspects. So there's so many different aspects of cultural tourism, but I really think it helps define a city on what a city has to offer and what a city represents to the world in terms of its offerings and drawing people into the city for these great cultural events and attractions.
Well, I must say that Chicago certainly does have an abundance of cultural attractions and offerings that should accommodate the taste of any visitor to our great city. What I'd like to do is to ask you to talk now a bit about the neighborhoods in Chicago where cultural tourism is an important factor. Can we do that?
Absolutely. You know, our Chicago has a culture of neighborhoods, in a sense, as you know, Dr. Hughes. You know, Chicago, due to its immigration patterns, you know, so many different immigrant groups came to Chicago and settled in these wonderful ethnic enclaves, if you will, you know, where you had your churches working as your social services and your merchant streets where you start getting business opportunities. So in a sense, as Chicago was founded, we had all these wonderful neighborhoods set up through Chicago. And then it's still true today. And, you know, our neighborhoods really help differentiate us from other cities, that we have these wonderful neighborhoods that have great cultural offerings for visitors. So when they come into the city, yes, they can do the downtown attractions, but it's very important, and every visitor should explore some of our neighborhoods while they're coming to the city of Chicago. And in a sense, you know, it gives us great pride. The residents of Chicago take great pride in their neighborhoods and make sure that they are invested in their neighborhoods. And it's really important to bring visitors to our neighborhoods for the economic impact, going to the great restaurants, going to the cultural organizations, and maybe doing some shopping when you're in one of these, you know, great cultural neighborhoods throughout Chicago.
Can you, let's talk about some of those neighborhoods. What about some of the landmark neighborhoods in Chicago? Can you talk a bit about the role cultural tourism plays in those communities and perhaps the impact cultural tourism has on those communities?
Yeah, the first one that does come to mind is our great Bronzeville neighborhood, the great African-American historic neighborhood on the near south side of Chicago. And I really hope, and I know there's a movement, and I really think it will succeed in becoming a national heritage area here in America. And, you know, Bronzeville offers so many great cultural tourism opportunities through the historic sites in the neighborhood, through some of the music legacy in the neighborhood, to really draw people in to understand its history, its sites. And then again, it's, you know, if we can draw visitors into these iconic neighborhoods, these, you know, cultural neighborhoods, we can start showing the economic impact as more people come in and go to the restaurants and the cultural organizations and do a little shopping. So, you know, Bronzeville comes to mind right away. There's some other neighborhoods, of course, the Pullman neighborhood. Great history, great story to tell. The architecture is still basically fully intact, so you can fully experience the culture of Pullman. And it really, you know, Pullman has so many links to other neighborhoods through its history there that it's very important to, you know, visit Pullman and really understand its full impact on the entire city, I believe. One other neighborhood that comes to mind is also on the southwest side is the Pilsen neighborhood. Great, today, a great Mexican-American neighborhood. You can have a full, you know, cultural experience there through the museum, the National Museum of Mexican Art, have wonderful regional Mexican cuisine, take in some of the street art scene. So those are some neighborhoods that come to mind right away when we talk about cultural tourism.
You know, one of the things that we talk about frequently on this show is how should I say, African-American communities in particular don't participate in the area of tourism as most communities do, because we have not had the experience or the education about tourism to help us better understand the advantages that are available under the umbrella of tourism. And there's also the double-edged sword, because as communities evolve and tourism becomes a focus, there's also the risk of gentrification of some neighborhoods. And so I wondered if you might have some feedback or have some thoughts on that particular angle.
You know, I would agree with you that it is a double-edged sword in a sense. And if you look at certain neighborhoods that have gone through major transition from, you know, what would be considered, you know, not a great area to visit to now is absolutely booming. And, you know, obviously real estate prices do start to go up. Storefront rentals start to go up. And so you can, you know, you can see that in certain neighborhoods of Chicago. I would agree with you there. But, you know, tourism, if we can start drawing people to a neighborhood, it does give business opportunities. You know, hey, we're getting an increased visitation to this neighborhood. Let's open a storefront. Let's open a music venue, or let's open up an art gallery. So I think, you know, when you're bringing more visitors into a neighborhood, it does give entrepreneurs some business opportunities. But again, I will say I do agree with you that there is a tipping point in a sense where the neighborhood becomes such a destination, so popular, that rents, real estate prices can go up and can push out the people living in that neighborhood. And, you know, we do see that through various neighborhoods throughout Chicago.
Well, it is sort of, I guess you would call that a cost of doing business, because it does happen. But what we hope to do is to, through programs like this one, as we talk about tourism, to enlighten and educate people about the opportunities that are there, so that people don't sit and wait until it's too late. But because there is, you know, I often say that tourism is one of the last bastions of economic opportunity that does not come with a lot of barriers and boundaries in terms of who can invest and who can invest in tourism venues. And all of the things, the list of things that you just described, are those kinds of, present those kinds of opportunities, and even smaller venues or opportunities or shops that can emerge that will service tourists that come to a particular place.
I completely agree with you, Dr. Hughes. And, you know, I think Pullman is ripe for that investment. You would hope that you're educating the local residents first through some of the community groups of the potential of the, you know, they're saying, you know, hundreds of thousands of visitors to Pullman in particular, since it's a national park now. And you really hope the residents that are already living there become empowered to invest in their own neighborhood, continue that investment. And then, you know, since they're already living there, they stay there and they're not, you know, pushed out to another neighborhood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jason, do you have anything in particular that you want to talk about?
You know, True Chicago is involved with so many things across, you know, various disciplines. We're going to start promoting, obviously, the holiday season coming up. It's a great city to come in, do some Christmas shopping, take in a lot of our traditions across various neighborhoods for the holiday shopping season. And since, unfortunately, as you know, winter's right around the corner, we'll be getting right into Chicago Restaurant Week, Chicago Theater Week. It's a wonderful opportunity to take in Chicago's vast theater scene, And then Chinese New Year will be on us. We do a big citywide Chinese New Year celebration at the end of January.
Well, Jason Lesnevich, everybody, from the Chew Chicago entity in Chicago, Illinois, is our guest for today. And we thank you for coming on. We thank you for taking some time out of your Sunday to share with us and enlighten and inform our listeners. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Hughes. And anytime you need me, I'm available.
Welcome to another edition of Around the Museum Table. This is a segment of our show where we invite individuals from museums around the country. And since this is an international show, hopefully very soon, in the very near future, we will have guests from around the world. And to be able to come on and talk about the museum that they represent and tell us all about what's happening around the world at their particular museum. Our guest today is a Mr. Samuel W. Black. He is the director of African American Programs at the Senator John Hines History Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Lauren Davidson, writer for the Pittsburgh Magazine, wrote about him that Mr. Black, who is one of the most noted contemporary scholars of African American culture, is changing the way people look at Black history through his work. And we are honored to have him as our special guest today on this segment of Around the Museum Table. Mr. Black, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're very pleased. We're very pleased. I'm in awe of your work. And maybe, I don't know about the people in the listening audience, how many of them, probably many of them know more about your work than I do. But I am in awe of your work and very, very proud to be able to have you here today. So let's start by your telling us a little bit about the Hines History Center and your work there.
Oh, sure. The Senator John Hines History Center is the oldest cultural institution in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was founded in 1879, and it consists primarily of the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania, the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum, the Fort Pitt Museum in downtown Pittsburgh, as well as the Museum Conservation Center and the Meadowcroft Historic Village of Rock Shelter. So it's a organization that, similar to a mini Smithsonian, where you have a number of different museums all under one roof, under one roof in a sense. And my role there is that I overlook all of the African-American programs, African-American collections, both museum and archival, as well as I curate exhibits and I write and publish on different aspects of the African-American experience.
My goodness, you're a very busy person.
Oh, yes.
That's very impressive. You have a very impressive body of work before you. And I haven't been there, but I'm going to make my way there to come visit the center so that I can see firsthand. You are a very unique guest for us today because you wear a number of hats. But I would first like for you to talk a little bit about or give your perception about what museums mean to the tourism arena and what role museums play in the tourism arena.
Okay. I think that really depends on where the museums are located. For instance, a museum in Miami, Florida, or Washington, D.C., or New York City, or Philadelphia, cities that attract, and Chicago, cities that attract large tourist numbers, and tourism is a major part of their the industry and the economic health of that particular region. For us in Pittsburgh, although we do get quite a few tourists, we're not known as a big tourist, you know, mecca, in a sense, where tourism is not a major part of our economy in Pittsburgh. So it's just a little different thing. We do count that when we're considering our projects and how effective our museum should be. We kind of rely more on a domestic visitorship, but for museums in general, those that are in regions where tourism is a major part of the economy, museums play a major role. And all of the cities that I mentioned all just happen to have world-class museums, and one of the reasons why is that they want to attract the tourist trade. And museums also play a role in a sense of bringing dollars to the region, because it also brings people who like museums, or it brings organizations to hold their annual meetings in their cities.
I'm glad we took that path on answering the question, because what I really would like to do, and I didn't tell our listening audience this when I introduced you, but you are, I guess it's safe to say that you're president emeritus of the Association. Immediate past president of the Association of African American Museums. That then, in my opinion, enables you to wear two hats. And so you have a unique perspective in looking at how museums interface with tourism or are a part of the tourism industry.
Mm-hmm.
And and you made a very good point about how the, you know, small museums, how they play a role, because as you know, we're the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, and I'm the founder of that, and we are a small museum, but I find that we play a major role in the tourism traffic in the city of Chicago. So I'd like for you to be able to make a few comments or to discuss that, if you will.
Oh, certainly. Some of the museums that I am more familiar with in terms of their impact on the tourism would be some of the museums like in Boston, the African American Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. They operate two campuses, one in Beacon Hill, which is, of course, a historic district in Boston, and the other one on Nantucket Island. And both of those, you know, areas are very heavy in terms of tourism to the city of Boston. So the museums play a major role. The Boston campus is partnering with has a partnership with the National Park Service. They conduct tours of the facility and that Beacon Hill area. It's called an African-American Heritage Trail of Boston. And the buildings that are the historic properties that make up the museum, the African Meeting House and the A.B.L. Smith School, are historic properties important to African-American history. They're two of the oldest such buildings in the country that were built by African-Americans and maintained by African-Americans. The campus in Nantucket, on Nantucket Island, is the same thing. You have a historic home that was built by an African-American ex-slave, Seneca Boston, in 1774. So those are two tourist attractions. And, you know, so it's a very much a part of both Nantucket Island tourism and the Boston tourism, in a sense that they draw people there. And what we, in a sense, of those of us in African American museums have been arguing for a very long time, is that local tourism boards or convention bureaus or visit centers, as they call them today, are more and more starting to take a second look at African-American museums and include them a great deal more in their advertising for tourism and visitation to their cities. Because especially in Chicago, not only a Philip Randolph Museum, but you have the DuSable Museum of African-American History.
Absolutely.
That are very well known nationally. You have the Harold Washington Library, Vivian Harsh collection at the public library there are all very well known and, you know, not only attract visitors to those museums and libraries, but also researchers. And so, you know, what I've noticed with African-American museums is that they've been able to not only capitalize on the local visitor and visitation, but also reach out to those who are venturing into the city for whatever reason, whether it's vacation or for business or whatever. I'll give you a quick story. It's a personal story, but I had a traveling exhibit a few years ago called Soul Soldiers, African Americans in the Vietnam Era, and it was at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, which is the Lorraine Hotel where Dr. King was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a cousin who knew very little about my project. He knew I was doing a project on the Vietnam War, but he lives in North Carolina, and he was traveling in Memphis on business. And as he told me that whenever he had a couple of hours of free time during his business trips, he always liked to go visit museums. So, of course, he's going to go to the National Civil Rights Museum, and he walks in. And he goes to this exhibit on the Vietnam War, and there's a picture of my brother, who was a Vietnam veteran, on the wall. And so my cousin was really, he became emotional because my brother passed away in 1971. And so the people at the museum didn't believe him when he kept saying that was his cousin until he started shedding tears. And then they believed that he was probably telling the truth. So that was a story that both he told me about as well as the museum people told me about. But here you have someone who is visiting another city on business and ventures into what? An African-American museum, and had no idea that there was something personal and family related in that museum. But it's the fact that people are choosing to go to African-American museums for whether it's for leisure or business or, you know, social or whatever the occasion may be.
You know, that's a very interesting story, and I'm glad that you share that with us. But you know, it brings about a very good point. Museums, I think people have this notion about museums that they're sort of just stagnant places to sort of go. And I think what we in the museum community have to do is to find a better way to let people know who we are and what we really do, because we are teachers. We are cultural institutions, so it's a two in one, and it's a repository for reflection on many things that have to do with our culture. In the last year, I will share with you that since the designation of the Pullman National Monument, we have had a solid year of an influx of international visitorship. And these are people who come and they specifically want to know about civil rights and Black history. And so it is not just, I think that people, there's a misnomer or misinformation about what's at a museum and what kinds of things that tourists want to see. I think that those visitors centers and visitor information centers that you spoke about earlier, I think we have to do some work on them, frankly, to let them know who we are and what we do, and maybe bring to their attention the interest of international tourists, because people are coming and they want to know about this history. We have people from Asia, we have people from Europe, you know, all of these different audiences of people who you would never think would be interested just assuming ourselves, we're assuming. We never thought that people would want to come to America from other places to see and to learn more about civil rights and African American history. And so I think that it's almost like the time has come for that particular genre, if you will. And I think it's very important. And I think probably the idea that we had an African American president contributed heavily to that interest, but better late than never, I would think. And so I just wanted to share that with you since you shared the story, because I think we're sort of saying the same things that people who are traveling and they just sort of come. People who just want to visit museums, and just like your relative went into to that National Civil Rights Museum, he had no clue that he was going to come upon something that touched him in a very personal way. Mm-hmm.
There is another example that's similar to what you're saying, the River Road African American Museum in Donaldsonville, Louisiana. This is a rural area between New Orleans and Baton Rouge along the Mississippi River. And this museum basically chronicles black rural life in Louisiana and near the sugarcane fields and so forth. So a lot of their collection really is evolves around an agrarian sort of society. So it's all farmers. It's a history of black farmers. It's a history of struggle, working in sugarcane fields, and so forth. And in 2014 and 2015, a surprising percentage of their visitorship were foreigners, mm-hmm. people from Eastern mm-hmm. Europe and people mm-hmm. from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
their director, Kathy Hambrick, was trying to, you know, get a hold of it in a sense, or understand it better of why, and was even, you know, had a survey of their visitors, their foreign visitors, asking what brought them to the River Road African American Museum. And more than often, you know, the answer would be that they were just interested in black
mm-hmm.
history.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that tells you pretty much what you were saying, is that there is a foreign audience that is interested in black history. They want to know more about the experiences of African Americans. They want to know more about, you know, how does America define democracy, and the fact that looking at the experiences of African Americans give them a better idea of what democracy is or isn't.
Yes.
And this is one of the things that is drawing a lot of foreigners to African-American museums, because, after all, African-American museums tell that story better than anyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this is very interesting. Very interesting. We're going to have you to come back to be a guest again around the museum table. But I want to reiterate that this is a part of the show where you get to talk to our listening audience about whatever you want to talk about. Let's say, for the sake of this discussion, there's something you want people to know about that's coming up, or you want to promote something that's happening at your center. This is where you have the opportunity to do that, and we'd love for you to just take a few minutes and talk about anything you want to talk about this coming up.
Oh, sure. We're doing so many things. Let me narrow it down. I am very much into collaboration, and over the past 3 or so years have been doing programs with other organizations around Pittsburgh. And one of those is a long-term program that comes out of an exhibition that we opened in 2012 called From Slavery to Freedom, that looks at the African-American experience, of course, the background of slavery, but it also looks at a little bit at African civilizations, and then focuses a great deal on Pittsburgh in terms of Pittsburgh's abolitionist history and civil rights history. And One of the, I guess we'll say, sort of new and exciting areas of the exhibit, because a great deal of it was original research by myself, was a section where we call Surviving Off the Land, which basically addresses how runaway slaves were able to sustain themselves in the wilderness or on the journey to freedom. And so we looked at 50 different foods or plants that grew in the area between the Gulf of Mexico and the Pennsylvania border, or the Mason-Dixon line, and the Mississippi River and the Atlantic Ocean. So we looked at that region of the United States, and primarily before the Civil War, so we're looking at the antebellum period, and then we took a look at the slave narratives that have been written, and we researched the different plants that grew in that particular area and the relationship those plants had with African Americans. And so a great deal of our research chronicles what plants, what flora were used for sustenance, were used to make medicines, were used to make weapons, were used to make clothing, and was used to make shelter. And this research we put into a website, and it can be found at the HeinzHistoryCenter.org website. All you have to do is look for From Slavery to Freedom exhibit, and you will find the bulk of that research. But we're continuing to work on it because there's a book publication in a couple of years about it. And this is original research where it's basically a runaway slave story, but it's looking at it from a different point of view. We're putting the reader on the ground with the escaping slaves. So it's a little different in a sense, but our collaboration is with the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy that has just recently opened, as of September 10th, a redesigned and renovated environmental center that is a completely recycled center. It recycles all of its water. It uses solar energy to provide electricity and energy for the education center. And we also put a From Slavery to Freedom garden there. And we'll grow plants that are derived out of my research so that we can educate the public about this aspect of the freedom movement. So that's something that we're really anxious on. The plants will be, some of the plants will be planted within a couple of weeks now and will bloom in the spring. And so our programming will really kick off in the spring and the summer and the fall months around this whole subject. And it's something that we're encouraging a lot of other museums to do. And our partnership with the Frick Environmental Center works out because if anyone's familiar with Pittsburgh, Frick Park is one of the largest urban parks in the country, similar to, I guess, in New York you have Central Park, and then there's MacArthur Park in D.C., and Los Angeles, and in other places you have these big city parks. And, of course, in Chicago you're all quite familiar with how effective parks can be, not only as places of leisure but as education sites as well. And so that's what we're doing here in Pittsburgh, and we're really happy with it, and we really hope that it turns out very well.
Well, it's interesting, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking back to something, Ford Bell, who was the former president of the American Alliance of Museums, and something he said, something he was quoted in before he retired from there, which says the museums are charged with coming outside of the walls. We're charged with engaging the community and doing more with less. And so the traditional role of a museum is evolving and is changing. Mm-hmm. And so we are doing very similar kinds of things that you just mentioned. And so I would love to have a conversation with you off the air to have a further dialogue about some of those. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can give us some advice. But this has been an absolute fantastic interview with you, very informative, and I thank you so very much for joining us today.
Sure.
Our guest today from around the museum table, Mr. Black from the Heinz History Center. Today's show is partially underwritten by United Auto Workers, Local 551, and Hughes Peterson Publishing, Chicago, Illinois. This was an absolute fabulous show today, I think. Very informative. And so at this part of the show, I want to just remind listening audience again to visit the PullmanMessenger.com and purchase your annual subscription. The magazine is published by Hughes Peterson Publishing. You can also purchase an anthology of respect available at Amazon.com and visit the museum's website, the PullmanPorterMuseum.com. Find out a little bit more about what we're doing. You can also purchase an annual membership. The museum, the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, is not supported by city, state, or federal funds. And so our operations are dependent upon the kinds of things that we do outside of the normal operations. And so those are things like the magazine that is published and memberships and special events and programs that we have. And you can find out all about those things on our website. Visit the PullmanPorterMuseum.com. And of course, you can visit our website live from the Pullman National Monument and find out all about a little bit more about the show and who we are and what we do. We're thrilled to be able to have this opportunity on BBS Radio to allow us to talk about something that we love and that we enjoy doing. And so I want to take a moment to say thank you to all of the listening audience for listening to our show. Thanks to our guest, Jason Lesnevich from CHU Chicago, Mr. Samuel Black from the John Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, our executive engineer, Mr. Don Newsom, our producers, McIntyre Evans and David Peterson, our technical producer, our technical advisors, Antoinette Wright and Keisha Shavers, and of course, our sponsors, United Auto Workers, Local 551, and the Chicago Neighborhood Initiative, for sponsoring today's rendition of Live from the Pullman National Monument. And we'll see you next time.
Live from Pullman National Monument was brought to you by Hughes Peterson Publishing in Chicago, Illinois. Hosted by Dr. Lynn Hughes and produced by Dr. McIntyre Evans.